It is 8:32, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover, and a couple minutes less than we normally have. And so let's start out with the mayor's race, which is... seems to be adding someone to it every week now.
Yeah, we for a while we couldn't get anybody to run, and now it seems like everybody wants to run. Maybe somebody's noticed that nobody likes Greg Nichols. But now we have Councilmember Jan Drago entering the race, which is kind of interesting because as one former city council aide told me a couple of days ago, between Jan Drago and Greg Nichols, you couldn't slide a piece of paper between the two of them when it comes to their stance on policy issues. And they're going to fundraise from the same sources because they're both very much beholden to big downtown business interests. But Drago wants to make this race all about personality and the fact that nobody likes Greg Nichols, that he's hard to work with. Well, you know, the dirty little secret of that is not many people like Jan Drago either. But
yeah, I find the word style and Drago in this to be incompatible in the same sentence, actually.
Yeah.
But she says it's a matter of style difference.
It's a matter of style difference. She wants to run the city exactly the way she wants to run it, and Greg Nichols wants to run the city exactly the way he wants to run it. Understand the difference? So we now have those two. We have Mike McGinn, who's the former Sierra Club head, who wants the city to take over the city schools, and we have James Donaldson, the former Sonic, who is a small business owner who thinks he's qualified to run the city because he once ran a small business. It's really a pretty discouraging field. There is a rumor at this point that Peter Steinbrück is going to throw it in his hat at the last minute after all, but I'd be pretty surprised if that happens at this point. He's really given no indication of his own. I think that's more wishful thinking than anything. But, you know, if I'm proven wrong, hey, I'm happy to be proven wrong. At this point, though, it looks like that's going to be the field, and for all the candidates that we now have in the field, given that we talked for a long time about wanting to have candidates and that we didn't have any, now we've got a bunch, and frankly, none of them are very good.
Nope. All right, moving on to the King County Auditor position.
Oh, yeah, the King County Auditor is going to be coming up for sentencing here on his hit-and-run vehicular driving while intoxicated charge. And once he is sentenced, he's going to be pushed out of office and someone will have to take his place. Lloyd Hara, a current Seattle Port Commissioner, has declared that he wants to run for King County Auditor, and he's put in his name to become interim auditor if I think it's the county council would look at the candidates and select someone to hold the office in between now and the November election. And this is kind of interesting that Hara is sort of ditching the port while he can. It's pretty clear that the recent scandals at the port have made him decide that that's not such a great place to be anymore. Yeah. I remember he ran for port commissioner in 2005, was elected to the office as somebody who was promising reform and to look at the books more closely. That didn't happen during his tenure.
Yeah, although he has sided on the commission more often with reform policies than several of the other commissioners there. So
he was also
depending,
one of the
if he does wind up being appointed to the auditor's seat, that's going to create a vacancy on the King County Port Commission. And given that I believe
the Port of Seattle Commission,
and given that that would be filled by the other commissioners, and that currently there a majority. Majority there is the old boy and old gal network that has been leading the culture of corruption there for many years, and that in turn would be a huge advantage as an incumbent leading into a race in November. It doesn't look very good at the port for having any kind of systemic change anytime
soon.
Yeah,
and it would this happening just this week, we haven't yet heard of of who might be running for his open seat on the Port Commission. I'd encourage some decent people to run right now.
Absolutely.
All right. And finally on local, a update on Nicholsville.
Yeah, Nicholsville, the encampment that started nearly a year ago now, with various homeless advocates being arrested for trying to camp out on public land down on Marginal Way. Those charges were dismissed yesterday against the Nicholsville 25. Nicholsville itself is now located down in Renton, and they're going to be moving again next week, so to what they hope will be a permanent location, although they're not releasing the name of that permanent location just yet because, well, they're afraid that it might not be permanent. So we'll see how that goes, but they could certainly use any help for that move.
All right. That takes us to national and this week's Supreme Court nomination. Been getting a lot of airplay.
Yeah, Sonia Sotomayor. Much of what we've been hearing in the media is, of course, conservative opposition, which is boiling down to her anti-white male bias, which I'm sure Jav would like to talk about.
Well, speaking as a middle-aged white male, I'm outraged. I'm absolutely outraged that that somebody would make a case in public as Sotomayor did that somebody other than white men would be best qualified to rule in any particular kind of particular case. That, of course, that statement has been taken wildly out of context, as I believe they mentioned on Counterspin a half hour ago, mm-hmm. that she was making the case specific to cases involving gender, and she had all kinds of caveats to that. But that one sentence taken out of context has been the fodder for quite a bit of conservative commentary. And part of the problem with the conservative criticism of it, of course, is that first they're making the automatic assumption that, well, on the face of it, that statement is problematic, and yet you know, even if you take the statement out of context and say, well, you know, she's a Latina woman, therefore she's better qualified to make a decision. First, you have to prove that that's an incorrect statement. And given what middle-aged white guys have done to the planet, I'm not so sure that that's an incorrect statement.
What's interesting to me is that there's all this focus on the race issue, and Sotomayor has proven herself to be right in the Democratic mainstream with most of her decisions, except for two. One is ones that are based on discrimination, employment discrimination, where she tends to go pretty far left. She tends to support employees versus their employers when it comes to cases of discrimination. There's another instance where she's not in the Democratic mainstream, and that's when she is supporting big business.
Not to cut off a woman, because you know that would be something
that never happens.
Very, very much like a white guy to do, and it is my prerogative after all. But this is something that has been common to Democratic and Republican nominees for the last generation, without exception. Every nominee to the Supreme Court for the last 25 years has been extremely corporate friendly, and Sotomayor is directly in that lineage.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Obama has pointed up the fact that she was born in the Bronx and comes from a family that started out very poor. Well, they did start out very poor, and they did live in the Bronx in a housing project. And her father did die when she was eight, and her single mom raised her and her brother. However, she did not spend her whole childhood in poverty. You know, she lived in a middle class neighborhood for much of her teenage years. She went to private schools, she got scholarships and went to very expensive colleges, very prestigious universities. She's worked at high-powered law firms. She has represented corporate clients. She's been pretty much went from being born in poverty to jumping right up the ladder, leaping, in fact, right up the ladder through the Democratic Party ranks. And so she does have both. She had an early perspective of what it's like to be poor, and then she spent most of her teenage years and adulthood as someone who is in the upper class.
Yes, so she has empathy for the rich as well, is what you're saying.
Yeah, so she has empathy for the rich, and that's where her interests lie now. you could argue. So whereas she might be going onto the Supreme Court and arguing for minorities, I don't know that she has as much empathy for the poor as folks might assume. In addition, what I think is going to be interesting is right now we have a Supreme Court that's run by a Chief Justice who has never seen a race-based case that he won't try to dismiss or ridicule in some way. So it'll be interesting to have her on the court, a feisty, outspoken Latina woman who is going to defend and want to hear cases based on race and will sympathize with the folks who are claiming discrimination. When there's a Chief Justice who finds those cases to be utterly ridiculous and tries to dismiss them as much as possible, it'll be interesting to see if she manages to ruffle the feathers of the very slick and very unflappable Chief Justice John Roberts.
All right. I just had an email come in saying that, and I think I'm to blame on this, that when we were talking about the King County auditor, it's actually the King County assessor.
Oh yes.
I started us wrong. I wrote down auditor instead of assessor.
So we followed right along. Which, yes. You know, as another white, middle-aged white guy, your leadership is once again proven out.
Well, yeah, you got behind me correctly, John.
Yes.
But Maria should have resisted. So,
what?
All right. All right, moving on with Supreme Court. Moving on to, from the nation's Supreme Court to California's Supreme Court.
Yes, and a most unfortunate decision this week on Proposition 8, where the California Supreme Court upheld the initiative that is essentially banned gay marriage in that state. There now is a very, very active recall, which jump-started in the, 15 or 20 seconds following the issuance of that decision to repeal Prop 8. That will go on the ballot in California in 2010. The efforts to organize that are already underway, and we're already seeing, of course, referendum 71 here in Washington State, which is a very similar effort to repeal the legislation that was passed. Actually, the way that it's worded, we would have to vote affirmatively to uphold the legislation that was passed in Olympia this past session that would give domestic partnerships the same rights under the law as marriages. The folks are out trying to get their signatures. They have a little under 7 weeks in which to do it to get that on the ballot. So if you see anybody anywhere who is trying to gather signatures for Referendum 71, a lot of that will be circulated in churches, but I'm sure there will be some in public areas as well. I wouldn't urge anybody to harass those folks. That would be unseemly and anti-democratic and so forth. But certainly you should decline to sign, and you should explain to everybody within earshot
why you are declining
to sign.
Well, I think that's a good rule in general, looking over something that you're signing.
Oh, yes.
That's not crazy. That's not a bad idea.
Always read it.
Always ask questions.
Can you sign off on that?
Yeah, I can sign off on that.
All right. Moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, this week the big news is the GM bankruptcy. General Motors had until June 1st to come up with a reorganization plan, because on June 1st they owe a $1 billion debt payment that they can't make. And so that was the deadline for them to work out a deal to reorganize with their debtors. Bondholders said no to the deal that the company tried to make. Apparently the company hadn't offered them enough. They'd offered them about one third of their initial investment back, and bondholders said, "Oh no, no! If we go to bankruptcy, we'll get more money out of you." We'll see if that actually happens. In addition, some of the bigger bondholders had purchased a lot of credit default swaps. Credit default swaps are an insurance product. Essentially, it gives a debtor, it gives them insurance that in case the person they've loaned money to can't pay and ends up in bankruptcy, then the insurance contract will pay. And so many of the bondholders who held those credit default swaps added up, they ran the figures, and they figured out that, well, if GM goes into bankruptcy, we'll actually get more money from the credit default swaps than we would have gotten if we'd cut a deal with GM. I think that's an instance in which derivatives and these creative financial products like credit default swaps are a real hindrance to doing business in America, and inimical to the way the system ought to function. The U.S. government forced a change to the deal with GM, so that now taxpayers will be on the hook for $30 billion to give GM another $30 billion in order to get about 72.5% of the company's shares. And it'll be about 6 to 18 months before the company will denationalize. So in essence, GM is going into bankruptcy. They're going to be nationalized. The U.S. government will own the majority shares.
What's good for General Motors is good for America.
Yeah. Now, that's pretty risky. I mean, if you think about it, the U.S. government taxpayers are taking control of a company that's in dire financial straits. Excuse me. Don't know what's going on today with my throat, but anyway, yeah, it's a company that's in dire financial condition, and it's not at all clear that GM can become competitive again with other companies like Toyota Motors or even Ford Motor Company, which is in better financial condition. So it could be that in, you know, 6 months to a year, the company could completely implode and taxpayers would lose their entire $50 billion investment that the government has made into General Motors. In addition, I want to just point out that Obama is going to be making a speech on Monday giving us more details about how the company is going to be structured once it heads into bankruptcy and makes its way through bankruptcy, and who will be running it. So, in other words, he'll let us know who's going to be fired and who's going to be replaced at General Motors and how much control the U.S. government will have over the day-to-day operations.
Now I have what may seem like a really stupid question.
Uh-huh.
How come the Obama administration can take an active role in the management of General Motors, but for the banks in which it is pouring far more money, we don't exercise any controlling interest whatsoever?
Whatsoever. I know. There's a much, much, much better argument for doing this with banks. However, the Obama administration has not done that. And I think part of the reason is because a lot of the people who are managing his economic team, they all come out of the banking industry, or they have had very close ties to the banking industry. And, you know, there's probably a question of who among the Obama administration owns stock in major banks as well. Because when the government takes over and nationalizes a company like it has, when a company's forced into bankruptcy like it has with GM, then shareholders lose 100% of their investment. Shareholders are completely wiped out. It's bondholders, people who own company debt, who actually manage to get some of their money back. So that's it. That's one of the issues, too, with nationalizing banks. Now, the other news this week is we heard a lot about how the end is near, the end of the recession, that is. And I just wanted to look at that a little bit because, you know, there's been a lot of hype about the stock market being up and consumer confidence is up and so forth.
Yes,
and
can you break that down for us, Professor Doom?
Yeah, I'll do that. The National Association for Business Economics, the NABE, they released a survey this week, a survey of economists, and among the economists that they surveyed, over 90% said that the recession will end this year. 74% expect it to end in the third quarter, that's in July or September of this year. 19% expect it to end in the fourth quarter, that would be October to December of this year, that's a total of 93%. The remaining 7% expect it to end in the first quarter of 2010, and then there are those of us who manage to never get surveyed, who think that it's going to be a lot longer than that. The Fed also thinks that the economy may be headed into an upswing. They announced that they wouldn't increase the amount of money that they're pumping into the economy this week by saying, you know, we're not going to buy more treasury bonds than we have been, et cetera. So the question is, are they really right? Well, there are a lot of indicators out there that argue against that view. In the NABE survey that they did of these economists, 71% of them said that consumers would be more thrifty in their spending habits for at least the next 5 years, Well, that seems to be a major argument against a recovery this year, because consumer spending accounts for about two-thirds of the economy, and nearly all of these economists have said in the past that the economy is not going to recover until you see people starting to spend more. So it's very strange that in this survey they couldn't articulate how the economy might recover if consumer spending is going to stagnate for up to 5 years.
I believe the technical term for that is voodoo economics.
Yeah, I think it's irrational optimism. Anyway, there is also the evidence of interest rates. Long-term treasury bonds have been falling in price for the last week or two, and their interest rates are going higher. So, you know, with bonds, if the price falls, the yield or the interest rate goes higher in order to attract investors to buy more bonds. In addition, long-term treasury bonds tend to set the interest rates on long-term treasuries tend to set the mortgage rates for mortgages tend to be linked more to long-term interest rates than they are to short-term interest rates. So as the rates on long-term treasury bonds go higher, then mortgage rates go higher. And we saw that this week, that mortgage rates are jumping up already. Didn't take long for that to happen. Also, rising interest rates can be an indication of impending inflation. When you have inflation on top of a recession, that's usually referred to as stagflation, something we had in the 1970s, and that's extremely hard to get out of. So that's not necessarily an indication that we're turning the corner. If anything, it's an indication that things could be getting worse. And of course, as you know, we've been reading the housing statistics on the air lately, and housing prices are still going down. With mortgage rates going up, people having less of a chance to refinance, that's not a good sign. So finally, on the economic news, I just wanted to talk a little bit about a couple of accounting tricks that might also be making the situation worse. Banks are able to write down the fair market value of their loans, but they also can do a little accounting trick later. They can look at the interest received on those loans in the first quarter of this year, and then they can multiply that out over the life of the loan and call it accretable yield, and then bring that back into their balance sheets to make their balance sheets look better. That expected revenue is called accretable yield. And that's a little accounting trick that is making banks right now look in a lot better shape than they actually are, especially when you consider that most of those loans could default, or many of those loans could default in the future, a lot of them being adjustable rate mortgages and option arms as well. And then there's a accounting trick number two, which is to sell your bad loans to yourself. Banks have been lobbying the FDIC to allow them to take part in the program where they get government money to buy some of these risky loans off their own balance sheets. They would then take those risky loans and put them into special purpose entities, in other words, off balance sheet entities, which would supposedly make their balance sheets look better, but they would still have the loans on the books, defeating the whole purpose of the program. And, of course, milking more taxpayer dollars.
So. All right. Well, then that takes us on to international, starting with North Korea.
Yeah, North Korea went boom this week. There was both a test firing of rockets and also a nuclear detonation. And we're hearing a lot about its impact on nuclear disarmament in general, and the idea that we have nuclear weapons in the hands of an irrational state and possibly in the hands of terrorists and so forth. This is coming at a time when the United States is getting ready to negotiate on several different benchmarks of international disarmament treaties, particularly the START II treaty that's set to expire this coming month with Russia, various other treaties that are coming up. And because arms control experts were basically drummed out of the Bush administration, the Obama administration is way behind behind in hiring people who have that kind of expertise for the new administration. So a lot of the fear-mongering that's going on around North Korea right now is having an impact that we're going to see in bilateral negotiations with Russia and in multilateral negotiations to try and continue and to expand in any kind of international arms control regime. So it's a very dangerous time for this to be happening in terms of its impact on domestic politics and the Obama administration's ability to advance any kind of disarmament agenda. So I just wanted to, I know we're short on time, but I wanted to put that out there.
All right. And a UN Human Rights Report that came out.
Yeah, a Human Rights Report by Australian law professor Philip Alston that called the United States human rights record deplorable. He is the special rapporteur on extrajudicial executions, and here's the quote. There have been chronic and deplorable accountability failures in the United States with respect to policies, practice, and conduct that resulted in alleged unlawful killings, including possible war crimes in the United States international operations. They're talking about torture deaths at Guantanamo, Iraq, and Afghanistan, mostly but not entirely in the Bush administration. And, of course, those chronic and deplorable accountability failures continue all the way through the Obama administration, since nobody is being held accountable either within or outside the military for any of those deaths or any of the torture or any of the mistreatment of prisoners that's taken place and continues to take place.
All right. And events for today?
A couple of them going on today, actually. 12:30 today, a Health Care for All rally and march that will start at Pratt Park at 18th and Yesler in Seattle. The 7:30 guests, I believe, are speaking on UW at 4:30.
4:30 p.m. at the Communications Building, Room 120.
Yes.
At the
UW.
And they'll be speaking on?
On Bhopal.
On the situation of Bhopal.
And then we have also a rally on Wednesday in favor of teachers and opposing the recent Seattle School District teacher cuts. That'll be a rally just before the school board meeting at the school district headquarters, 5 to 6 o'clock on Wednesday, before a 6 o'clock board meeting. The school district headquarters, the Glass Palace, 2445 3rd Avenue South. Thursday, Town Hall Eduardo Galeano will be in town at 7:30. Get your tickets early for that. That'll be popular. And then Friday at 7:30, Keystone Church, the Media That Matters Film Festival, and of course SIFF going on all this coming couple of weeks as well.
Very good. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found around town in places where you find other free periodicals, in bookstores, cafes, coffee shops. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, or want to volunteer, Job, what's the phone number that you call?
Area code 206-719-6947, or email us at info@eatthestate.org.